some sense, I expect the viewer to have to like choose, really, you know, like, what am I going to look at? I mean, what am I going to listen to? Because you can't, it's not really cognitively possible to get it all. So, I sort of feel like sort of apologetic and unapologetic at the same time about that kind of cognitive overload thing that I do. Because, you know, but the simultaneity of image at the same time that the text is running, you know, is a way to use that more or less kind of surrealist idea of juxtaposition to kind of question how meaning is produced.
That's hilarious. Thank you. It's hilarious.
The word. I appreciate that because, you know, when I show this work, sometimes it's, you know, there's some obvious moments where humor, there's some expectation of humor, and sometimes there isn't. It isn't obvious. So I always feel like really uncomfortable with certain kind of works where it's not like the third one. The second one is a little more obvious, or some more less obvious from humorous moments, I think. But then that's not the case with the third one, which I also think is funny, you know?
Dark.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dark humor, but still humor. But it's in fact, if in the best of all possible worlds, I would want to have a plant in the audience at all times laugh at this or at that moment, just to sort of signal that it's like it's to cross that threshold between yikes and humor.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the humor thing, you play against it because, for instance, the use of voiceover is a very specific tool that you use, and I'm curious as to how you choose the voices for it, because the voiceovers are very authoritative, and you can't escape that because we're all conditioned to read voiceover when it's delivered in that way to be the voice of authority. So I'm curious about how you, the decision-making process you engage with to choose the voices that you have selected.
Yeah. I want to argue against that, though, if I may. I think that the voiceovers aren't authoritative. I mean, they just undermine themselves. They sound like they ought to be. Yeah, they sound like they ought to be, but then when you listen to them, you think, if there's some authority being expressed here, from what place does it come? Because there's no place for that voice to be there or for it to claim responsibility morally or politically. It's sort of self-undermining all the time. So yes, it sounds like, you know, it's clearly articulated and it has a self-confidence built into it, but it can't sustain itself by the kind of voice, like particularly the last one when it starts singing. It's just as if like, there's almost a tone, in some instances, a tone of self-mockery.
But who do you choose? Like, are these all professional actors or friends?
Yeah, they are professional people, particularly, there's this, I don't know, like, we're a separate nation, we get, you know, there's that British accent thing, which all carries this, you know, we hate it, but it does have this strange, it does still maintain a quality of authority. So I chose that quite carefully. And also the male voice in the second piece was very kind of, you know, 1950s NFB kind of thing, you know, really kind of, you know, but what he said didn't carry anything of that you could hold on to. So I choose them in order to kind of, I think, increase that kind of irony. Some of the later ones, I don't do that anymore, I think. For this, for example, the voice in the third piece, I wasn't thinking about authority in that way anymore. Let's have the voice of authority, but then let's have them not say anything authoritative. I think I just liked, you know, at the risk of sounding superficial about this, I think I just liked her voice. I think I just liked the quality of her voice, you know.
Two-pronged question. Are you a parent, and are those your children in the work? And then if so, how do you feel about that, ethically? Putting your kids in here.
I'm happy to exploit my children.
Yeah.
In the first piece, that kind of grim fairy tale thing.
The boy and the girl, are those the ones who were in this and then?
There were two young boys
yeah.
were in that. The one who pointed to the closet door.
Okay.
A lot of that was found footage, clearly. But
yeah.
There were that, and that's a key image.
Okay, how do you feel about it? The question is, how do you feel about putting your kids over here? Like, do they can? Yeah, I don't know. You talk
about
this.
Moral? Oh, I have no moral compunction about this whatsoever.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, and they like it. They had fun. It was fun. It was good. There were no issues of, you know, you must do this, but I don't want to know what you must. There was nothing like that happened. It was all. Nor did I ever have them do anything that was in any way, you know, like questions.
Sorry. So you think it's more collaborative, or are you asking them to act? I don't know.
Well, they had no idea what I was doing. But that age, they had no idea what I was doing. So. Oh, also, I want to say that pointing thing. I didn't ask him to do that. We were in this place in Spain. He was doing this. He used to be such a show off at that age, and he was doing this tour of this kind of cave that we were staying in. And I just filmed it, and so I just used that footage. So I didn't. Actually, there was no directing there at all.
Was that sneaky prof footage of a party that you hosted of students? Was that sneaky prof footage of a party that you hosted of students?
I did attend, graduate student soiree. You sent that out.
Did they know you were filming them?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It's really funny.
Okay, there's some more things to look at, so I think we should probably.
I can talk forever. So I feel really happy in a place where you take me in the work, and then I think I get exhausted and annoyed by your adherence to title, voice by, like that, having to go back to that logic. It's like, bleh! And I actually have been closing my eyes, so I'm like, no, don't want to read it. It's too opposing. Why do you do that? Why do you put a title and credit things and format it in a logical way when the rest of your work is playfully illogical?
Are you talking about the...
Or just the format in terms of like, you put a title on your screen and then you have like credits to your people. I know people do this with artworks, but it's just, I'm annoyed and tired after being in a really, in a place of reprieve, I don't want to say, or like stimulated and like, yeah, I don't know.
But it's about language, right? Is it about language?
I find that shift difficult to like where you're deconstructing things and taking it somewhere and then having to just read that.
Well,
I don't know. I think it'd be fine.
It's possible that it's actually like that kind of cruel to make people sit through so many of these things. I think they're playing you on the best of all possible worlds would be best to show three, just three,
yeah.
You know, just three.
Maybe. Yeah.
Because they're all like that, as you can see, and they all have that. But let me say something on behalf of that kind of logical thing.
I'm not a video artist.
The last piece was probably the most, I think, pure version of what I think of as kind of nonsense in the visual arts. I mean, nonsense is well established in the literary environment, and it's really always about language, obviously. But there's a very strong tradition of nonsense in visual arts, you know, and some of the characteristics of nonsense are interesting to point out. Like, for example, nonsense is strangely logical. Its use of literalness is one of the tools that is most often applied in order to kind of undermine meaning, right? So if Marx Brothers are playing cards, somebody says, cut the cards, Harpo pulls out a hatchet and goes, thump. He did exactly what was asked of him, right? And so that's a pure kind of visual version of nonsense, and using kind of logic against itself is one of the tools of nonsense. So I tried to do that by kind of insisting on questions and answers, you know, like in the last one. Text that you can read as well as hear. There it is. I try and use kind of formal means to arrive at some kind of point of extraordinary clarity when in fact there's no clarity to be had there at all, like, semantically speaking. So, you know, one of the things that the nonsense forms does is it adheres crazily rigorously to syntax at the same time that it undermines semantics, if that makes any sense. So, you know, meaning falls away if you're insistent on regarding the rules of logic. If you take logic to its rigorous extreme, we can't communicate anymore. Because, you know, one of the obvious things about language is it's deeply, deeply metaphorical. So as in the Harpo Marx example, right? So if you refuse metaphor and insist on literalness, communication just comes to a halt. So there's a kind of, I mean, I'm not saying that I do this in every work with the same kind of consistency or anything, but overall, I do like to propose a certain kind of formal transparency at all times. And then let the kind of semantic disillusion happen on some other level. Yeah?
Are you familiar with the work with Rebnikov for this point? Rebnikov for this point, who developed the language of nonsense and died in 1922. So, if you're familiar, your ideas from his book. If you're not familiar,
I didn't get the name.
Lebnikov.
Yes, of course.
If you know his book,
I do.
Then it's very clear for me. Very clear for me what he's doing, and we're trying to develop, like he tried to develop new language, and language of cosmos. He said it's two parts. Language might be for cosmos, or language for ordinary people to use for just to read. And he said, first letter of the word, it's enough to give meaning to the word. Mm. So sound was very important. I thought
right, the sound.
We were kind of going very parallel to the
Like talking about, and also Daniel Karms, I don't know if there's another Soviet era nonsense writer.
And the kind of, you forgot about that. In a way, you kind of bring it back,
I very much appreciate that. I mean, there's something about, just going back to the era, Antonin Artaud said something about, I don't try to change the manners of men, I don't seek to change the language of men, I only try to point out the fragility of their thought. And that's kind of, I really like that phrase, and I think there's nothing here. I mean, I don't try to persuade anybody about anything here, right? There are no rhetorical claims here, unless you want to dig down at some tertiary level and think that there are, which is indeed possible. But certainly on the surface, no substantive claims are being made. But it's always about challenging representation, using nonsense forms like Plotnikov and Daniel Carnes and so on and so forth to have us question why we believe what we believe, where does this come from, why do we feel so secure in our beliefs. So it's the work is more, and I would claim that as the political dimension of the work, through nonsense, the challenge that is made to forms of representation in and of themselves, and to the assumptions we make about the beliefs that we have and the thought processes that they hold so dear. And that's what nonsense does. That's what Lewis Carroll did in his Alice books, for example. I mean, it just, there was communication ground to a halt because of the attentiveness paid to the norms of language, right? Okay, there's two more. Oh, okay, another question?
I don't know if it's a fully formed question or thought. I just, there seems to be a lot of, just imagistically, there's a lot of nostalgia.
The old footage?
Yeah, the old footage, the childhood images, the childhood voices of a very particular era, a sense of the past, and the sense of nonsense. I mean, you keep saying nonsense, but I keep thinking that it's not actually nonsense, it's just a different way of making sense. And that way of making sense in relation to the images I'm seeing makes me think of like a child making sense, or this kind of real rigorous logic that children devise when they're like their tea parties or whatever, their games, that they're like, this is the way it has to be, and it makes sense to me, even though it might not make sense to anybody else. So it feels like that you are trying to make kind of sense. It's just that the sense that you're making doesn't necessarily compute with a different kind of sense that we normally, or whatever normally is. But I guess I'm just curious a little bit about this sense of the nostalgia and of the child and of a particular time and place.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a third, maybe more of this is made of found footage. I would say just for the sake of argument, there's two kinds of found footage. One is like the really specific kind that has a very a common cultural knowledge about what it is and why it's, and what the reference is, as it were. So, to take an obvious example, airplanes hitting buildings, everybody knows that it's a shared and it's existing footage, right? Then there's another kind of found footage, which is really general. You don't know where it came from. That's the kind that I use. I use unspecific footage, and all I hope for it is that it gives the sense that it emerged from a cultural context. That it already has existed, and that it already has done some job somewhere regarding making a relationship with other images, maybe producing meaning, and so on. And I find that dimension of it important. There's just a sense, the nostalgia part is that, most of this stuff is, it's like old NFB films, abandoned NFB films and stuff like that. That's where this stuff comes from.
There's millions of, reels of footage that reference a lot of different eras. I mean, you could very easily have chosen, with the text and the material that you're talking about, you could have chosen images of objects or images of landscapes or images of, but you have, you very specifically have chosen images of children and images of a particular era with particular conventions in that era. So it's not just found footage. I mean, you've chosen this very, very, very particular place and time.
Yeah, children, any, they're, this culture, I would not think that I could in any meaningful sense go to some other culture to get these such images. At least it has to be within my own culture. But other than that, I just choose the one that seems the most appropriate for the piece, but there's a high degree of arbitrariness to this, clearly. You know, it could, there's how many images of children might there have been for me to choose? There's a huge pool of possibilities out there. My expectation for that image is that it be kind of good and appropriate for my specific purpose, but at the same time that, as I said, that it carry with it just the sense of having been already immersed in our cultural environment, and that it's old, like it's used, it's been around. This image, it's not some fresh young child that just came into the world, you know, it's not this person's child or that person's child. It's childicity, as Glenn Barrett would say, you know, it's childness, you know, that it just has a, I mean, it's kind of like, I feel very influenced by Samuel Beckett, actually, and he always uses generic stuff. It's just a generic person. It's a generic tree. It's just a generic ocean. So I try to kind of strip it of specificity as much as I reasonably can. I'm hoping no one asks why. I think we should probably move on. There's two more. Are we all okay for watching two more? Okay.
This is a chronological order from first one to the last one.
No, I don't think so. You know, never put together the order. I have to say, I really like the order. I mean, God Eats Himself should come last. I realized having done that before. Also, you might have noticed some weird dates, like I don't know, like 2013, 2016. I mean, there was a couple of instances where, you know, I did an initial edit and then felt really didn't like it, and so I just put it away for a while and then re-edited it. In the case of God Hates Himself, I really just wasn't, that's delicate material, I just wasn't sure that I would handle it well enough. And I put it away for a while, then pulled it down to the end and talked to lots of friends. And some of them were like that. I think there was a couple others that had those kinds of dates, with early and then later dates. It wasn't chronological.
But so this lapse of time, has there been a change of strategy from your point of view? Your object.
I think I've been more inclined to explore, to really go kind of more, to go after the kind of constituent elements of thought and belief, because it just seems more interesting to me. I don't know if I can justify it any other way. It's just kind of personal predilection plays a big role in these things, right? Before I was more inclined to have some documentary elements, like God Hates Himself, you know, edited in amongst other, I don't know, what conceptual or more experimental elements. But no, I don't have a sense of a change of strategy, really, to be honest. I mean, I don't know, I sort of have a shtick. I just do this thing and find variation on it. But actually, that last one was quite difficult, wasn't it? So I think, yeah.
God Hates Himself is very different.
Sorry?
The God Hates Himself is very different.
And that's very different too.
No,
yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah, that's true. The last two. Yes.
Very harsh reality.
I wasn't seeking out that interview with Prosper. I was I was in Kampala doing another project, not represented here, and I was, and it was associated with the ferocious anti-gay stuff that was going on in Uganda at the time. And I had a gay friend, and I was visiting him, doing a project on that. Like I said, it's not here. Anyway, I was in Kampala forever trying to get these interviews, and I was lonely as hell. I mean, I knew one person. But somebody gave me, and that's another story, but somebody gave me Prospera's cell phone number. And I don't usually do this kind of thing, but I was sort of desperately lonely, so I phoned him up, and there he was, this completely broken man. I mean, he was this serious, serious trauma. Anyway, I spent a lot of time with him. And so that I ended up with this interview. He told me this incredible story. And I really didn't know what to do with it. I wanted to honor it. I didn't want to fold it into my thing. You know, you can see this ethical issue, right? I'm sort of changing the topic now, but anyway. I didn't edit that interview at all. It's complete, beginning to end. It's completely unedited. And it stands so much apart from the other two parts of the piece that I kind of eventually, and like I said, getting some comfort from friends who said it's really okay to, I felt like it was okay to, you know, to frame it this way. One of the reasons, unless there's other questions, I'll just go on about this. Concerned about the ethical implications of putting this interview with this other stuff, and I was reading material on trauma and the representation of trauma. This is a fantastic book by Jill Bennett called Empathy and Sensation.
Emphatic Vision.
Thank you. Yes. And in it, she talked about. So maybe you're welcome to say something about this if you like. But in it, she talked about, you know, the difficulties of representing trauma, particularly in instances. I have no experience of anything remotely like this in my life. So there's no sense in which I can be said to have empathy with Prospera. Lots of sympathy and all that, yes. But empathy, no. I mean, there's no parallel experience that I can draw on, right? And I was very troubled by this. Anyway, Jill Bennett talked about, interestingly, about the impossibility, the difficulty of representing trauma, because, I mean, language fails us at the best of times, in the context of, you know, pain or something. We don't know how to talk about that. We don't have language. And there's all kinds of other instances where we know that our symbolic apparatus that we made available to us, terribly clever that it is, just can't represent the depth of experience that we have, right? And trauma is just an obvious example of this. And it's not only the case that people who haven't experienced it have this representational difficulty, but even people who themselves are traumatized, just as surely as somebody who experienced pain, has considerable difficulty even talking to a doctor about what the experience actually is, right? It's classic. Language fails us, you know, and when we need it most. in this book, Empathic Vision, Jill Bennett talked about, I don't know if she uses this term, but something like framing in such a way that in a properly experimental mode, juxtapose with experiences that might be seen to be more, experiences that other people have had. So hence that, you know, that narrative about, you know, that kind of existential narrative, right, about the two girls who felt like they were the world didn't believe in them. Anyway, yes, that piece is very different from the other pieces. Uses some of the same strategies, I think. Like there's a sense in which there's some questions there about belief, and so on. And there's some juxtapositional strategies, obviously, about a traumatic experience juxtaposed with a story, and so on and so forth. But with a completely different, you know, sensibility to it. Yeah.
Has Prospero seen it? Have you talked with him about how he feels about this, or what maybe his purpose was in sharing this story with you, or his vision for what it could do?
Yeah, well, when, like I said, when I was hanging out with him in Kampala, and I asked if I, he really wanted to tell this story. Not surprisingly, like, he was completely isolated. He really, and the idea that somebody would videotape was, and maybe shorts anywhere, was really exciting to him. I tried to explain what I did, and of course I have no sense that he really grasped it, because, you know, frankly, why would he? How would he, the kind of work I do and so on. But he was, and I said that I, you know, would probably find some form of representation that was, you know, in conjunction with other things. And he said, oh, that's all fine, it's all fine. So, you know, yes, he was completely agreeable at the same time that no, he really, I don't feel like he grasped.
Because he'd be thinking about all those international help organizations he was talking about, maybe something like that.
Yeah, it's not, yeah, maybe. It's not clear. Anyway, he, since his email address doesn't work and his cell phone number doesn't work, so I'm going probably back to, I did a documentary about a women's center in northern Tanzania, and I just finished that documentary, so I'm going back to northern Tanzania soon, probably in August, and I was thinking I might go to Kampala to try and find him, but I have no idea how I would find him, to be honest. I have very few clues. Kampala's a sprawl. You know, in the small part of town, it's a sprawling city. Anyway, I despair of the idea of the chance that I'm actually ever located. Yes, so that's the Prospero story. A difficult story.
Interesting. What, how did he understand what you do and what would be his expectation as to what you produce?
What, how he received this?
How, what he expect from this? Did he even understand what you do, or he just thought he was willing to?
He just wanted his story to be told. He didn't, like I said, he didn't really, I'm not convinced that he understood how it would get out there. But anyway, that's why, you know, the interview is just unedited, and it is what it is. I mean, it's so powerful in and of itself. You can forget the other type parts of the work if you want to. Or you can segregate, you can think the other parts are different works, the way, you know, because a lot of these works blend together anyway, right? But that really stands out because by virtue of difference. So I thought, you know, even in the context in which, you know, what there would be, there might be ethical questions about framing it the way it was. I, to be honest, I feel fine about it now, given the fact that it has such a high degree of autonomy. You know. But yes, very difficult, just a very ethically difficult situation. There. Yeah.
I didn't know you made that documentary films. So.
Well, I don't. I made one about, well, I'll just say this real quickly, because I knew people in Moshi in northern Tanzania. I know lots of people there. So. And there's a woman who are, Mama Mende, who I knew quite well, who ran a Tanzanian NGO, just incredible, a Tanzanian educated lawyer. She ran an NGO based on women's rights. And so the documentary is based on a distinction that is actually quite important in Canada, even though we don't use this terminology. The terminology being, sorry, the difference between customary law and statutory law. Customary law being traditional law that emerges from generations of social practice that's frequently unarticulated, and statutory law is legalistic and it has this constitutional base. So Lamalinga uses, there's an unfortunate set of circumstances, particularly in villages where a husband dies and the woman is thrown off the land because the land just is given over to her male family. And there are endless instances where women are just thrown off the land with children or inherited by the brother or something like that, right? So customary law permits this. So Mamadou's approach is to take all of those cases to court, because they're easily won if you can get them to court. Because in the constitution in Tanzania, women's property rights are trumped, it's clear. So it's a long process, but she takes these cases to court and women are reinstated on their land with their children. So that's basically what she does. I had a similar ethical problem with this project. At first I was just helping out, I was just doing this, you know, kind of project with Mamadou because she was near retirement. People said, yeah, somebody should do a film about her looking at me. I don't think I do. But then I get stuck with. Then I have this representational problem again because statutory law is a Western imperial import, right? And customary law is indigenous tribal law, right? So here I'm some like white filmmaker from Canada making a film on behalf of this imperialist Western import. And basically I stayed out of this in the film. I mean, the film is really about Mamadou. She has nothing, she despises customary law because it has no capacity to protect women's rights. So basically, but you know, my name was on the film, and so there's this weird, you can see the problem, right? I mean, some white guy from Canada, I'm making a film that is deeply critical of customary law in a country, in a culture that's not mine, and I'm at the same time supporting Western legal institutions.
So how do you solve that problem? I mean, sure, it's a problem, but there's ways to solve it or to like address it.
Well, I sat on this project also for several years, and I talked to lots of people. And, you know, I'm not trying to minimize this ethical problem, but just about everybody I've talked to said you're overthinking this. It's, you know, yet, so what, are you just being a scaredy cat? Is there someone who's going to criticize you? Is that the problem here? Because basically, the information and the critique comes directly from interviews with Mamadou, and she approves it all, clearly. So, it is what it is. I mean, there's some contradiction there, but I either don't release the film or live with the contradiction.
Why can't you address those issues inside the film? I guess that's what I'm saying, is because I feel like there are issues, and I feel like in the film you showed, those issues were very palatable and very unpleasant, and I had a very viscerally difficult reaction to that film for many reasons. Like, I got it. Like, I understood what was happening with the different sections, but I found it highly problematic, and I think there's ways of it, like what you just said about this documentary film. There's probably ways of addressing it inside the film instead of just sort of brushing it away and saying you're overthinking it. I don't think you are overthinking it. I think it's present and it's very important.
Well, the consequences of going that route was somehow then it gets to be about me. Then it's about, oh, here's
but
the
it's always it. About you, it's your film.
No, this film, there's nothing, okay, there. If it was about me, here's the Western filmmaker struggling with this contradiction. Then, you know, the whole issue about Mongolian customary law, statutory law, women's rights in Tanzania would somehow take second place to the aestheticization of documentary as we receive it in the Western world with all its ethical problems that we talk about all the time. And I would rather live with the contradiction as it exists than, you know, rethink it according to here's the ethical problems that the Western filmmaker, you know, experiences. Because that would, you know, just Mbembe's whole process would just get set aside in favor of this other thing. I don't know why we're talking about this work in heaven.
Thank you very much.